Well, we are we're in a series called Seven Letters to New Denver Church, and I want to begin the message and the passage we're going to look at this morning. I want to begin by actually just asking you a couple of questions, and I really want you to reflect on these, and here they are. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being none whatsoever, 10 being unbearable, how much suffering, affliction, or distress, emotionally, physically, relationally, or spiritually, are you currently experiencing? If you had to write down your number, like what would you write down? In fact, maybe it would be helpful. Just write it down on your bulletin or think about it in your mind. What would the number you would place on that? How much suffering are you currently experiencing? Second question, how much persecution do you regularly experience because of your faith? What number would you put on that? How much persecution do you regularly experience? If you're here today and you're a follower of Jesus, I know maybe there's questions about that, but if you're a follower of Jesus, for those of us who would say that, how much persecution do you regularly experience in light of that? Now, the reason I ask those questions is because we're exploring a letter that was originally written to a group of people who are actually suffering a lot and experiencing a lot of persecution. Now, we call that letter the Book of Revelation, right? So we don't think of it as a letter, but that's actually what it originally was. It wasn't this book. It wasn't this mysterious. It wasn't the last book of the Bible when it was written. It was simply a letter written by a guy named John, who was one of the original disciples of Jesus. It was written in about 90 AD, so about 60 years after Jesus died on the cross. So a fair amount of time has gone by in the early church, the early Christian movement. And John gets this vision from God, and God says, I want you to write all this down, and I want you to send this letter, this vision, to these people at these seven churches in Asia who are going through a really difficult time in life right now. And so I've got a general message for all of them, and it's wrapped up in this big, bold, you know, broad vision. But I also have a very specific message for each of the seven churches and the seven communities of faith that are going to receive this letter. So at the beginning of the letter, and again, that's what we now call the Book of Revelation, at the very beginning, there are seven specific messages or seven specific letters to each of those churches that this letter is going to. And last week we read the first one. It was written to the church at Ephesus, and that was probably the most well-known church in Asia at that time. There's lots of other stuff in the Bible about Ephesus. But this week, let's look at the second one. This is what it says, Revelation chapter 2, verse 8. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. So this, where it says to the angel, that could refer to the pastor or the leader of the church in Smyrna. It could refer to the person who's receiving the message and is going to read it to all the people in Smyrna. It could refer to an actual angel. We're not fully sure. But these are the words that are written from and come from the one who is the first and the last, it says. So this is Jesus talking, and who died and came to life again. Now, what's interesting about that description is it directly connects to the city and the people of Smyrna. Let me tell you a little bit about Smyrna real briefly. Smyrna, we'll put a map up here. Smyrna is about 35 miles north of Ephesus, and it's on the coast. This is modern-day Turkey. It's on the coast there. And it had an ancient history. In fact, it had been around for more than, most people think, more than 1,000 years before the time of Jesus. But in about 600 BC, the city of Smyrna was destroyed. And it lay sort of dead for about 300 years. And in about 300 BC, it was rebuilt. It was rebuilt to be a part of the Greek and then later the Roman Empire. So there's a sense that almost the city itself had died at one point and had come back to life again. And it was when it was rebuilt, it became known as one of the most beautiful cities in all of Asia. Now, I don't have any great pictures to show you of the ruins or what it might have looked like back then, because out of all of these seven cities that we're going to read about, this is the only city that still exists today. In fact, the city of Izmir is there, and there's over 4 million people that live there, and it's all built on top of the ruins of ancient Smyrna. So we can't really see what the ruins look like we can see in Ephesus and some of the other cities. But in Jesus' time, it was one of the most beautiful cities in all of Asia. There were these two huge temples in the city. One was to Zeus, the Roman or Greek god. There was another temple to a local god. And in between these two temples, there was this famous mall that ran in between the temple. And it was known as the most beautiful and famous mall in all of Asia. And there was this shuttle bus that took people back and forth, up and down the mall. No, it wasn't like that. But it was kind of like the 16th Street Mall. Like, it was just well known. It was the main attraction, and everyone knew about it. And there were these huge temples on either end of the mall. Overlooking the city, there was this mountain called Mount Pagos. And on top of the mountain, there were these citadels or these forts that protected the city. And so these buildings you could see on top of this mountain overlooking the city became known as the Crown of Smyrna, because it almost looked like a crown sort of on top of the city. In about the time of Jesus, the city of Smyrna was part of like this contest across the Roman Empire to win rights to build the first temple to the Emperor Tiberius, where people could go and worship the emperor himself. And Smyrna won that contest. Out of the entire Roman Empire, they became the city that was commissioned to build this temple to the emperor. So people would go and they would worship the emperor there. People of Smyrna were really proud of their city. They thought it was the best thing in all of Asia. In fact, we found ancient coins that say Smyrna, first in Asia. Like, we're the best. We're better than Ephesus. We're better than anyone. We are the best. So people there were really proud of who they were. Kind of like Denverites, right? I mean, we kind of think our city's the best, right? Everybody should move here. Well, not really. We don't want anyone to move here, but we still want them to know it's the best. We're kind of like Texans that way. Let's be honest. We don't like to admit it, but we think Denver is just amazing. And the people of Smyrna would have thought the same thing. And so even when Jesus says, these are the words of him who was dead and has come back to life, who is first and last, it would have recalled this imagery for the people of Smyrna. But look at what he says when he turns to them next. Verse 9. He says, I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Now, let me stop there for a second, because Jesus basically says, let me tell you what I know about you. And he's talking now specifically not to all the people that live in Smyrna, but just to the followers of Jesus. It was a very small Christian community in Smyrna. He says, here's what I know about you. Here's what is defining your life right now. Here's what your experience is right now. Here's who you are and what your situation is. Three words: affliction, poverty, and slander. Maybe everyone else in Smyrna is having a good life. Maybe everyone else is going down to the theater. It had the largest theater in all of Asia, where people would go see Greek plays and they would see sporting events. Maybe everyone else can enjoy going to the temples and going down to the marketplace and the mall and all those kind of things. But I know for those followers of Jesus in Smyrna right now, I know what your lives are like. It's affliction. It's poverty. And it's slander. Because you see, the people who were the followers of Jesus in Smyrna during that time had a really, really difficult time. Let me tell you where this persecution or this affliction or all this slander and all this poverty would have been coming from, because it's an interesting backstory. The Roman authorities during this time in the Roman Empire, the Roman authorities required everyone to take part in Roman culture and Roman civic events. And essentially what you had to do is you had to celebrate all the Roman holidays. You had to go down to the temples and you had to bow your knee to Caesar and say that he was the Lord and you worshiped him. You often had to offer sacrifices to the Greek or Roman gods, because they were sort of part of the pantheon of belief. And you had to basically swear allegiance to who the emperor was and everything that the empire stood for. This was their way of keeping the Roman peace. I mean, everything about our system and everything about our culture and everything about our values is set up on this fact that everyone has to conform. Everyone has to be a part of what's happening here. They have to go do the rah-rah thing and say, yay, Rome, yay, Roman gods, yay, Roman Caesar, all those things. And if we can have that, then we'll celebrate the peace and the might and the power and the greatest empire in the history of the world, the Roman Empire. Everyone had to do this, except for one group, the Jews. The Jews were the one group within the Roman Empire that got an exception or a pass. They didn't have to do these things. And there's an interesting story there, because essentially when the Roman Empire came into being and they began to assimilate the Jewish people within their empire down in what's now Palestine, they realized a couple things. First, the Jewish people said, well, for starters, what we believe and the faith and the religion that we practice is way older than yours. Your Roman gods and your Roman empire is new, but we've been worshiping Yahweh and practicing our religion the way we've wanted to for more than 1,000 years. We have an ancient religion. And so the Roman authorities are smart, and they basically said, okay, we get it. You were here kind of before, and you were doing your thing before, and the Jews can be a pain in the rear. So we're just going to let them do their own thing. Because if we try to force them, they're going to rebel against us, and we're always going to be fighting with them, and it's just going to be a really pain. And so we don't want to do that, so they get an exception. And they were the one group around the whole Jewish, the whole Roman Empire that had an exception to the rule. They didn't have to go to the temples. They didn't have to offer the sacrifices, because that was against their religion. They could worship their own God and do their own thing their own way. Now, all of Jesus' early followers were what? Jews. Because Jesus himself was a Jew. And because his early followers believed he had come to be the Messiah of the Jewish people, the nation of Israel. And so the early church and the early followers of Jesus were just seen as a sect or a group or a minority or a subset of Judaism. They were just part of the whole Jewish thing. From an outsider standpoint, they didn't look any different than all the other Jews. There's some Jews who believe Jesus is the Messiah, some who don't, but they sort of all look the same to everyone else. They're just Jews. And so the early followers of Jesus, even though they came to the conclusion that Jesus hadn't come just for the Jewish people, but he had actually come to be the Savior of the whole world. And even though some non-Jews started joining the movement, they were called Gentiles. Early on, they didn't face as much persecution because they were just seen as part of the Jewish exception. But from about 60 AD to 90 AD, a whole bunch of things began to change. And I can't go into all the historical things that changed, but the end result is what happens during those 30 years is that the Jewish people started stepping back and saying, you know what? Those people are not part of us. These followers of Jesus are not part of us. And so they were going to the Roman authorities and they were saying, they're not part of our group. They worship a Roman criminal. They worship a guy who was crucified by the Roman authorities 40, 50, 60 years ago. Their religion isn't ancient. They're upstarts. They're like a cult. And have you seen what they do? They have these things, they call them the supper or the Lord's Supper, and they get together and they eat each other's flesh and they drink each other's blood. They talk about doing this. And they do, I mean, these people, you got to watch out for them. You do what you want, Roman authorities. We just want to let you know they're not part of us. And in Smyrna, we know that there was a very large Jewish population and there was a very small Christian population. And this isn't a criticism of the Jewish people. They were just protecting their interests and doing what they thought was best for them and their faith. But at the time, what it meant was huge persecution among these early followers of Jesus, especially in the city of Smyrna. So much so that Jesus says, I see the affliction you're experiencing. I see the poverty, because they were outcasts. They were sent out of their trade guilds. They weren't allowed to do business. Their businesses were shut down. Some of them were thrown in prison and there were trumped up charges put on them because they weren't worshiping the Roman gods and doing all of the Roman things. And so he says, I see your affliction. I see your poverty. I see the slander that these Jews are saying against you. I see the rumors and all the things that are going on in your lives right now. Now, before we read on, I want to point out one more thing about this line that I think is powerful. He says, I see and I know your poverty, yet you are rich. In other words, I see that you've lost a lot in your lives, maybe materially, maybe physically, maybe some of your possessions, your business, your livelihood, maybe emotionally. Maybe you feel bankrupt. Maybe you feel impoverished because you're facing all this opposition. You have no idea. But I just want you to know you're actually rich. Because the things that are most important, you have a lot of. The things that aren't very important, yeah, you don't have much of those right now. But what's most important, you are rich in that. And that's part of the whole letter that John is writing, is God saying, I see your situation. I just want to pull the curtain back and let you know that there's a whole nother story going on here. And you think you're in poverty, but you're actually rich. And maybe you're here today and you're going through a difficult time. And maybe you're here today and you would say, I feel impoverished too. Not maybe in the money kind of way, maybe you feel that, but maybe just in the deep soul, sort of like, oh, it just feels it feels like nothing's going right. It feels like I don't know how I'm going to get out of this situation. And maybe Jesus just wants you to hear those words right now. I see the poverty. I know the poverty that you feel. I know the affliction you feel, but I just want you to know you're actually rich. You're rich. Now, does that mean like God's going to just put a whole bunch of money in your bank account? Does that mean God's going to get that person back who's afflicting you? Like, does that mean that God's just going to make everything perfect tomorrow? No, that's not what God is saying, because look at what happens next. Look at how he continues. Verse 10, do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. In other words, it's actually about to get worse. Some of you are going to be thrown in prison. Now, prison in the Roman Empire is not like prison. Prison today is bad enough, because I've been there. You know, I did my... No, I've been told, and it seems like a horrible place. But prison today is very different than it was in the Roman Empire, because prison today is primarily about punishment. It's about you sort of do the time to pay for your crime. But that's a very modern concept. That's not the way incarceration or prison worked in the Roman Empire. They put you in prison for one of three reasons. One, to change your mind. You're not going to do what we say. We're going to beat you up and flog you and throw you in prison for a few days and then pull you out and see if you've changed your mind. Or second, they would put you in prison to await trial. Or third, they would put you in prison to await execution. But things never got better after prison. Like, prison wasn't just something that you sort of hung in and tried to wait out and things would get better. Prison was a bad thing. And so when he says things are about to get worse, some of you are going to be thrown in prison, to read that as a Christian in Smyrna and think, and he says, it's going to be pretty tough. You're going to be there for 10 days. He gets really specific. Some of you are going to be there for 10 days. And I think 10 days is interesting, because it's almost like he's saying, it's not going to be indefinite. Like, it's not going to be forever. There is a limit to this. But 10 days isn't 10 minutes either. Like 10 days is, it's going to be hard. It's going to push you. It's going to push you to your limit. You're going to fear for your very life. You're going to be thinking that the end of this is going to be execution. You're about to lose your life. And so what do you do in the midst of that? Here's what you should do. It's simple. Just be faithful. Just be faithful. Hang in there. Endure. There is no magic formula. Just persevere and be faithful and keep trusting in me. Even if it gets to the point where you think they're going to take your life and everything indicates that they are going to take, even if you think you're about to lose everything, trust in me and just be faithful. And if you do, I'll reward you. I'll give you your life as a victor's crown. And they almost could have seen the imagery either of this crown, this mountaintop over their city, or they probably would have been to many of the sporting games or heard about the Olympic games that took place when people won a race. A crown was placed on their head. And so it's as if Jesus is saying, like, just keep running. It's like a marathon. Keep running, keep persevering, keep enduring. And I promise you, I will reward you. I'll be with you. And then look at how he concludes. Verse 11, whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death. You see, there was a belief by the early followers of Jesus that one day we would all physically die. I think most of us still have that belief, right? That one day, our bodies are just going to decay and they're going to get to the point and something's going to happen, whether it's illness or some other thing, but we're all going to physically die one day. And if you spent, that was considered sort of the first death, but if you spent your whole life consumed with yourself, if you spent your whole life consumed with this life and just focusing on the things that you thought you needed, and you spent your whole life rejecting Jesus and his way and his life and his kingdom, and the early followers of Jesus believed that you would also experience another kind of death. It's like a death in your soul. And that was much more horrible because it meant you had rejected Jesus all your life and you had chosen to just separate yourself from him and the love and everything he had to offer you. And so there's all of these tragic and almost horrible descriptions of what that's like in the Bible because the biblical writers didn't know how else to describe it. It just seemed like such a horrible plight. And that was the second death. But what Jesus is saying here is just be faithful. Keep trusting in me. And even if they take your life one day, just know, they're not really going to take your life. You won't experience life where it matters the most. I will raise you up. I'm the one who one time was dead, but I came back to life. You will experience the resurrection life just like I did if you trust in me. Now, this is the shortest letter of all of the seven letters that we're going to read. And I think there's three powerful truths that I just want to point out before we wrap up today. And I think they're powerful truths that we can't ignore in this letter. And they're this. Number one, God uses suffering in our lives. God uses suffering in our lives. And I think we all know this at some level, right? I mean, most of us have experienced this. And think back on your life. All of us can recall a season of life where things were really crappy, right? Like nothing went well. People were stabbing you in the back and you weren't getting accepted. And they, like, it was just a bad thing. And we can all think and we all know suffering, right? And when you get to the other side of it, when you have some perspective and you can look back, most of us would be able to say, I've experienced one of those seasons where it was horrible and I had no idea how I was going to get out of it and how it was ever going to get resolved again. But for some reason, I look back now and I see that God somehow used it. My faith was strengthened in the midst of it. I trusted in him more than I ever have before. I relied on him more than I ever have before. And so we know this at some level. We know God can use suffering in our lives. And yet, what's fascinating is we all avoid suffering at all costs. I mean, don't we? I mean, who wants suffering? Who welcomes? Nobody wants suffering. I mean, this is natural. This is normal. This is logical. But what that means is we often try to avoid the very thing that God uses the most in our lives. If God can use suffering, oftentimes we're trying to avoid the thing that he wants to use the most. And it means we begin to see suffering as a problem or suffering as a weakness or suffering as something that's to be avoided. But that's not how Jesus sees it. When he wrote this letter to the people of Smyrna, every letter that we're going to read to these seven churches, Jesus always starts off with the good news. He always starts off with, here are the things I have to commend you for. Here are the things that are going well in your life. Here are the things that I'm really proud of you for. And how does he start that with Smyrna? Here are the things that are really good. I know your affliction, your poverty, and your slander, and the persecution you're about to go through. But if we could see it the way Jesus does, and if we could recognize that God sees those things as strengths, he sees those things as opportunities for the people of Smyrna because he knows that he can somehow strengthen their faith. And he knows that in the midst of that suffering, they're going to trust in him and they're going to rely on him, and they have the opportunity to call out to him more than they ever have before. And he knows that when they go through suffering, they're more like Jesus than they ever are at any other time in their lives. And so today, when I asked you in the very beginning, how much suffering or affliction or distress you're experiencing right now, not a great way to start a sermon, by the way. Like, not the most engaging initial question. My guess is most of us answer somewhere lower on the scale, but if you're here today and you like said, I'm a 5 or a 6 or a 7 or an 8 or a 9 or maybe even a 10, is it possible that God wants to teach you something in the midst of this right now? And that doesn't make suffering good. And that doesn't make it easy. And that doesn't mean it actually comes from God. And that doesn't mean he delights in it. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't be lamenting it like all of the people in the book of Psalms lament the suffering that they're experiencing. But it does mean maybe God can still use it and redeem it somehow. And would we be open to that perspective? There's a second powerful truth in this letter, and here is what I think it is. Following Jesus often brings persecution. Because the specific suffering these Christians are experiencing in Smyrna is persecution. In order to follow Jesus fully and faithfully, they're abandoning and giving up all of the idols that other people are worshiping and following in their culture. And when they do that, that's threatening to other people. That's going to bring other people to them, to afflict them and to say, why are you doing this? That's going to bring criticism. That's going to bring ostracism. That's going to bring all of those things. And so when you don't go along with the system and when you're not doing the sort of rah-rah patriotic Roman thing, like, you're going to bring suffering on yourself, persecution. And there are Christians who live in parts of the world today who are experiencing that same exact. They live in a society that is very against them, and they're making bold stands for their faith, and they're experiencing that kind of persecution. But here's the question that I think it forces me to ask, and I'm going to force you to ask it as well. It's this: how much have I compromised in my life in order to avoid persecution? Because following Jesus is countercultural. It's not normal. It can be strange and weird to people. It should be even threatening to some people. And so, are there ways that God is challenging me to live? Are there values and convictions God is challenging me to have? Are there patterns and habits God is challenging me to live out in my life? But I'm scared to do that because I know if I boldly hold to those things, or I boldly live those things, or I courageously adopt those things, people are going to say, he is weird. Like, that's odd. Like, that's just, we're not going to invite him anymore because he's kind of weird about that whole thing. Like, she doesn't gossip the way we all gossip, and it's weird when she kind of doesn't do the thing that we're all like. Like, how many ways in my life have I compromised what I feel like God is calling me to do because I don't want people to think I'm weird? And I want to keep impressing the people that I want to impress, and if I do that, I'm not going to impress them. And if I do that, I'm not going to get invited to things anymore. How much have I compromised in my life to avoid persecution? Third truth from this letter, and this is where I want to kind of conclude today. God is much more concerned with faithfulness than prosperity. Now, that's really tough because prosperity is a bedrock American value. We seek and desire and value, and I speak of myself, prosperity above almost everything else. We think the most successful and prosperous business people are the best business people. We think the best parents are the most successful and prosperous parents. We think that the best Christians and the best churches are the most successful and prosperous Christians and churches. We think that like success and prosperity is the goal of everything, and that I should be the most successful business person that I can be, and that I should be good at everything I do, and that everyone should like me at work, and that my kids should make straight A's, and they should excel at all sports, and they should never complain, and just grow up to get great jobs, and I should have an amazing house, an amazing IKEA furniture that I can put on Pinterest, and have my Instagram photos of my vacation should be awesome. Like, I just want to pursue prosperity and success more than anything else. And as a result, prosperity and success become almost the measurement of our faith. We mix it into this idea that maybe God's blessing is wrapped up in it. And so that when I'm experiencing success and prosperity, it's just a sign of God's blessing on my life. And if that's my perspective, that leaves no room for suffering and persecution. That means suffering and persecution are barriers to God's blessing. That means suffering and persecution are things to avoid in my life. And that's just not what the Bible teaches. There's a book of the Bible called Proverbs, and it does teach that prosperity can be a good thing. You read the book of Proverbs, and there's all these proverbs about if you make wise decisions, you'll probably prosper. If you raise your kids up with the right values, they'll probably grow up to be good kids. If you do all of these things, then you will experience a measure of success and prosperity in your life. And that's true, and that's good. But I love that there's a number of books in the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, because I often say there's Proverbs, and then there's two minority reports or dissenting opinions. There's the book of Ecclesiastes. It says, what happens when you achieve all the success and prosperity you could ever have and you still feel hollow and empty and life still seems meaningless? And then there's the book of Job that says, and what happens when you do everything right? When you follow God in all the right ways and you have all the right beliefs and you try to do all the right things and you still experience suffering and affliction in your life. And you see, the people of Smyrna, or at least the Christians of Smyrna, I think would have said to Jesus, Jesus, we're doing all the right things. We're trying to be faithful. We're living out our faith. We're rejecting these gods. We're trying to worship you. And we're experiencing all this suffering and persecution. And Jesus is saying, I know. I see it. And I'm so proud of you. Hang in there. Be faithful. Because I am so much more concerned with your faithfulness than anything the world would label as success or prosperity. And yet, we live in a culture that values success and prosperity. What's interesting is that there's two churches out of the seven that we're going to read that are the least successful by all the world standards. It's the church in Smyrna, and there's a church in Philadelphia we're going to read in a few weeks. They are the least, as historians have understood, they're the least successful in terms of size, numbers, and influence of all the seven churches. They're the only two churches that Jesus has only good things to say about. No criticism whatsoever. It's almost like you would look at the people of Smyrna and be like, yeah, I know the church down the road in Ephesus, I know they're really successful. But guess what? They're about to abandon their faith in me. They've lost their love for me. They are on the edge of forsaking me. They're a total mess. I know you're small. I know it's difficult. I know you're not successful in terms of any worldly standards. But I couldn't be more proud of you. Just keep being faithful. I'm so much more concerned with faithfulness than prosperity. Unfortunately, in America, we seem to often think it's the opposite. If Jesus were writing this letter to us, here's what I think he might say. Dear New Denver Church, I am particularly proud of you, and here's why. Some of you have suffered greatly, yet you continue to trust in me. Others of you have a desire to live out your faith more boldly and courageously, and you know it will not be easy. and it may not produce the results you desire, that's okay. Leave the results up to me. I can turn water into wine, storms into calm, darkness into light, and death into life. You wouldn't believe what I can do with just a kernel of faith. So keep being faithful. You do not have to be a perfect church. You're not, by the way. Just be a faithful church. Let me pray. God, we don't welcome or embrace suffering or persecution by any stretch of the imagination. But we want to make space for it in our perspective. And when it happens, we want to put our trust in you. And so for anyone who's here today who's going through serious illness or just emotional pain, loneliness, job stress, God, I pray that you would strengthen their faith in the midst of this, that you would be with them, that they would know you're not against them, you are with them. When your son was crying out on the cross, you know what it's like. You are with them. And God, you are with us as a community. Help us to live our faith in such bold ways that, yes, at times, it will bring opposition. And when it does, help us to keep trusting in you. I pray this in your name. Amen.